It's the first day of December 2025. The holiday season is officially upon us. Are you ready for it? Hey there, I'm Eric Dethridge, in for Craig Blumenschein for one more day. He'll be back with you tomorrow. Hope you had a bountiful Thanksgiving and safe travels back. Coming up, the fate of the lesser prairie chicken. We'll hear about efforts to save them, courtesy of a report from Harvest Public Media. Later in the show, a new mom's story of surviving a difficult birth and the expectations of new motherhood. And we'll pay tribute to singer-songwriter Todd Snyder, one of the core artists Mike Olson plays on his Into the Music show here on Prairie Public. First, Craig has this timely discussion about one of the most controversial issues of our time.
Today, we dig into a landmark decision from North Dakota's highest court, one that returns a near total abortion ban to full force in the state. After months of litigation and a Friday, November 21st split 3-2 ruling, the North Dakota Supreme Court found that although three justices declared that the 2023 law was unconstitutional, the requirement for a four-justice supermajority was not met. As a result, the statute stands. The law now bars nearly all abortions except if the pregnancy results from rape or incest in the first 6 weeks or when a, quote here, serious physical health risk, unquote, to the pregnant person is judged by a physician. The penalties are steep, up to 5 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for a provider. Here to unpack the ruling, its roots, and what comes next is North Dakota Monitor reporter Mary Stoyer, who's been following this story closely. Welcome, Mary, back to Main Street.
Hello, how are you?
Doing well, thank you, Mary. We're glad that you are with us to help us here. To begin, what are the key facts of the court's November 21st ruling, and how did the vote break down, and what were the main findings?
So three of the five justices found the law unconstitutional, and that was Justice Daniel Carruthers, Justice Lisa Fair McEvers, and then Judge Daniel Narum. I might be saying his name wrong, but he's a district court judge who sat in for Justice Douglas Barr. And they found that the law is unconstitutionally vague, so they agreed with the district court's findings on that point. And what that basically means is that they found the law is written too loosely or is too complicated to understand, which presents a due process problem. And so in their opinion, they wrote that there was a risk of doctors being prosecuted unfairly under the law because, you know, how can you enforce it adequately if no one can come to an agreement on what the law says in the first place? And then also an important extension of that is that they said there's a danger that medical professionals will also withhold care from patients because they don't know when it's legal or not legal to perform an abortion. And then on the other side of things, I can also talk about the dissent if you want me to get into that.
What's so odd here, and we're going to get through this, is we often hear at the federal level a 5-4 Supreme Court vote decided this or decided against that or maybe overturned an appellate court ruling, et cetera. But here, dissenting judges upheld the law's clarity and argued the state constitution does not apply a broad right to abortion. Walk us through their reasoning.
So the two dissenting justices, that was Justice John Jensen and Justice Jared Tufte, they took the stance that the law is not unconstitutionally vague. So a big part of their, what they wrote in their dissent is that they said typically in order to prove a claim that a law is too vague to understand, a party would have to provide enough evidence of it being enforced unequally. And they said the plaintiffs didn't have those scenarios to point to and were basing their case on hypothetical future conduct. And that's their words, not mine, instead of what had actually happened under the law. And then they also said in their analysis of the state constitution and what was going on at the time it was adopted, they said that there's no evidence to suggest that people at the time accepted abortion, and their understanding, like the historical context that they provided, gave them the impression that at the time of North Dakota's constitutional convention, most people only accepted abortion if it was provided when necessary to save the life of the mother. So they basically said, under that view, abortion outside of that very specific purpose probably isn't constitutional. And then on the other hand, they said that the plaintiffs didn't provide enough evidence that this specific law is too vague.
Mary Storier is my guest. She's a great reporter from the North Dakota Monitor. You can read about her substantial reporting about the Supreme Court's November 21st split 3-2 ruling. That's the North Dakota Supreme Court that found that essentially abortion continues to be banned in the state of North Dakota, except for extenuating circumstances. Mary, let's step back. What legislative and legal developments brought North Dakota to this point?
So a couple different cases over abortion in North Dakota were sort of launched after Roe v. Wade was overturned in 2022. So North Dakota, like many states, had a trigger law in place, and that's a term used to describe laws that were on the books before Roe v. Wade was overturned that set up the state to ban abortion when/if that decision ever came down. So North Dakota's law was initially passed in 2007 and was kind of like not active but waiting on the books just in case the U.S. Supreme Court ever decided to overturn Roe v. Wade, which of course they later did. When it became active in 2022, was immediately enjoined by a district court. Then litigation over its constitutionality ensued. The following spring, the state Supreme Court ruled that it was not constitutional. Then weeks later, the North Dakota legislature replaced it with the current law. Then that was challenged in court in later that year. The following year in 2024, a district court judge found that one unconstitutional. And then that brings us where we are today, basically. More than a year later, the state Supreme Court came down with this decision. So that's a very convoluted explanation, but it was basically since 2022, there has essentially been some sort of legal battle over abortion in North Dakota.
It's quite a timeline for sure. Mary, we mentioned this earlier. Law as it stands now allows abortions only in very narrow circumstances, rape or incest within 6 weeks, or when a serious physical health risk is determined by a physician. How were those terms defined? And where is the uncertainty in that real world interpretation?
That's a really good question. So the majority opinion in this case, those three justices basically said that those terms weren't appropriately defined. So in the opinion, there's this really interesting part where they include transcripts from some of the expert medical witnesses that testified for the state in the case. And the three justices basically present parts of these transcripts to show that many of these doctors had different opinions on what all of these terms mean. So serious health risk was kind of in the law. They said it was explicitly physical, like not a psychological condition, but beyond that, they didn't really provide detail. And so some of the witnesses that were asked about it provided different explanations on what they thought that term meant. And some of them said, like, well, it's a subjective term that kind of depends on the patient. There was also a term in there, reasonable medical judgment. Doctors appeared to also provide different conclusions about that. Then when it came to the rape and incest exception, the justices also made a point in their opinion that, you know, how is a doctor who has no law enforcement training supposed to arrive at a conclusion that someone was raped or that their pregnancy was a result of incest or some other crime like that? So I think that's a good question. And I think it's still kind of an open question. Like the dissent, Tufte and Jensen take the position of the fact that, you know, no statute is perfect, and enough guidance was provided to where an ordinary competent doctor should be able to arrive at a sound decision, just given the guidance on the books. But then they also said, you know, we haven't really seen situations where this was proven to not be adequate yet. Like, they sort of took the position of the law is sound unless you provide us evidence otherwise of like a real world scenario of this having negative implications.
What are the immediate practical implications of the decision for providers, for hospitals, or for patients even needing emergency or time sensitive care?
Yeah, I ask myself the same question. I think I've heard a lot of people say like, oh, this really won't change that much because North Dakota doesn't have an abortion clinic in the state anymore since the only provider moved across state lines to Moorhead a few years ago. At the same time, you know, this is very much beyond my level of expertise, but I have heard that, you know, even if you don't have a place providing elective abortions, there are still going to be doctors in the position of, you know, if someone's at the hospital and they're facing a serious health condition and they're pregnant, a doctor could still be in the position of having to make a decision on whether or not to perform an abortion at sort of a run-of-the-mill hospital, is my understanding. Like, just because they're not at an abortion clinic doesn't mean that they're not authorized to provide emergency care. And so that means there are still going to be doctors having to make this decision in the state regardless. We have tried in the past to kind of ask medical providers, ask hospitals, like what their policies are, how their practices have changed under the current law, and have tried to ask kind of as the courts have made different decisions on this issue, like, how is this going to change your day-to-day life? Like, are you telling your doctors different things? And we haven't exactly been successful. I understand why hospitals would be reluctant to talk about that. So it's hard for us, I think, to get an inside glimpse into what doctors might be doing differently. I do think the case does provide good testimony from doctors who were in a position to share their concerns. So there is that. And I know when the ban was put into effect, I did hear stories of people having to travel across state lines to get abortion care. And so I assume that could be the case again. They might have even had to continue doing that even when the district court enjoined the law, like suspended it, because sometimes it's hard to know. You know, I assume sometimes hospitals might be reluctant to allow this care, even when the law is technically like still on the books. Even if the law is technically enjoined, if it's still on the books, that might still intimidate doctors.
You've done some research about North Dakota being a state where a supermajority is required in this case to overturn a lower court ruling, but you found out that's very rare.
Yeah. From what I know, the only other state that requires a judicial supermajority, so more than 50% of justices, to declare a law unconstitutional is Nebraska. And Ohio used to be similar, but apparently they voted to take away that requirement back in the 60s. So it's only North Dakota and Nebraska for now.
Do you know whether there'll be any discussion on whether to make it a simple majority?
I haven't heard anything yet. I imagine some people will be thinking about it, because I have seen discussion mostly just online so far, just because it's so recent, but I have seen people online asking questions of like, you know, most justices thought this law was unconstitutional. And yet, you know, it's still on the books. Like, what's the basis for this? Like, I talked to one attorney today who told me it's very rare for the state to even be in this situation. Like, it's not common for the Supreme Court to opine on constitutional matters anyway, but for it to be a 3-2 decision that ends up keeping a law like this on the books is of course even more rare. So it seems like it just doesn't come up very often. And so people kind of forget that our state has this requirement.
I've wondered, since North Dakota's Supreme Court justices are elected in Wyoming, where I have experience and where I live most of my life, the Supreme Court justices are appointed, whether this will provide fuel to the fire, so to speak, and make North Dakota's Supreme Court justice elections more political than they've been in the past. You thought about that?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if any justices are retiring or when, like, who's running up at the end of their 10-year terms. Yeah, that's a very good question.
What open questions remain in what you plan to report, Mary, and where will you be focusing your continued coverage about this issue?
Well, I'd like to hear more from people about what they think about the decision. I think from what I've heard, because the decision basically says the plaintiffs didn't provide enough concrete evidence of, or at least the dissenting justices said, we want to see a situation where that clearly shows that the law was too vague to understand and that got someone in trouble before we take another look at the claim that it's unconstitutionally vague. So I'm wondering if that's potentially in the future, like if anyone will be in that situation and then consider filing a lawsuit. I'd like to know what lawmakers think, because even though the law still stands, I think the Supreme Court had a lot to say about what they think about the legislature's work here. You know, the majority opinion criticized the legislature and basically said that they failed their responsibility to make laws followable. So I wonder if anyone will try to amend the law during the next legislative session, or if they're happy with the outcome as it is. I'd be interested to know if anyone is considering trying to circulate a petition to change the supermajority requirement, or maybe to change the Constitution to add a right to abortion. I think that's a possibility, because the dissent noted that they sort of took the stance that the state constitution doesn't imply a right to abortion past unless there's a serious health risk. I mean, and they said they acknowledged that that goes against public opinion about abortion, but they basically said, if you want this to be in the Constitution, you have to put it in the Constitution. So I'm going to be looking out for that, and I'd like to know more about how the law is affecting people. That's sort of my plan.
That was Mary Stoyer. She's with the North Dakota Monitor. You can read her excellent reporting about this and many other topics online at the NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Mary, thank you for your reporting and your time. Ultimately, the North Dakota Supreme Court's ruling means the state's near total abortion ban is back in full effect for now. The path ahead will involve how the law is applied and how exceptions are interpreted and whether further legal and legislative shifts follow. Mary, of course, will continue to follow this. Mary, thank you so much for visiting with us on Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig.
And a quick update to our story. North Dakota Supreme Court Justice Daniel Crothers has announced his retirement. He served on the court since he was appointed by then-Governor John Hoeven in 2005. He was then elected to an unfinished term in 2008 and 10-year terms in 2012 and 2022. He announced his retirement last Wednesday in a letter to Governor Kelly Armstrong. Crothers' letter did not state the reason for his retirement, and you can read Mary Stoyer's story about his retirement in the North Dakota Monitor.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans. And by the Bush Foundation, in partnership with Strengthen ND, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize North Dakota honorees, TNT Kids Fitness, and Hip Hop and Hope. More at strengthenND.com. You are listening to Main Street on Prairie Public on this Monday, the first day of December. Hope it's going well for you. I'm Eric Detheridge. Craig Blumenschein will be back in the hosting chair tomorrow. It's a pleasure to have you along. I know I always get a kick out of seeing the prairie chicken from the side of I-94 when I drive by Rothsay, Minnesota. But it's serious business in the southern part of the U.S. when it comes to trying to preserve the bird. Here's a report from our partners at Harvest Public Media.
In the southern Great Plains, the lesser prairie chicken was once a common sight, but much of its habitat is now gone, and its numbers are dwindling. In recent years, the federal government has flip-flopped on protections for the bird, first awarding, then removing endangered status in Texas, and threatened status in Oklahoma and Kansas this summer. Harvest Public Media's Anna Pope reports on how states and landowners are continuing the conservation efforts.
The wind whirls through the grass as Kara Brown treads between buildings where native birds are bred and raised.
Prairie chickens in general are at a decline, so you hear a lot of people who have seen them. They grew up seeing them all the time, and now they don't see them.
She's a program manager here at the George Misk Sutton Avian Research Center in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Its scientists work to conserve native birds through surveys and breeding programs. There were once millions of lesser prairie chickens, but about 90% of their habitat has been lost.
It's kind of this important thing to do what you can to make habitat suitable and do what you can to conserve these the species and their wild populations.
Today, there are only 30,000 lesser prairie chickens found in five states, Oklahoma, Texas, Kansas, New Mexico, and Colorado. Even so, Kurt Klukinski with the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation says the bird has been on and off the threatened species list for years, most recently off. He says landowners generally want to help the birds, but the changing rules have made it harder.
The bird was listed, then delisted, listed again. Now it's being challenged for a second delisting. That adds greater confusion and uncertainty to landowners, and it creates an atmosphere of maybe distrust is the best word.
That second delisting came this summer when a Texas federal judge ruled the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made a mistake, granting the bird Endangered Species Act protections and removed them. Environmental groups are appealing the decision. But in the meantime, wildlife departments in Oklahoma, Kansas, and Texas are updating a multi-state plan to conserve the species. And Klukinski says those conservation efforts will largely depend on landowners.
They're our greatest wildlife conservation partners. You know, 95% of Oklahoma is private land, and we have very few public land parcels that the government can manage to the benefit of the species. So we rely on our conservation partners who are landowners, private landowners.
Some landowners are taking part in conservation efforts independent of state efforts. Mark Gardner owns about 48,000 acres near the Oklahoma-Kansas border, where he raises and breeds cattle. He's part of the Lesser Prairie Chicken Landowner Alliance, a recently formed group to benefit ranchers and the bird. Gardner says lesser prairie chickens belong on his land.
Oh, I love them. I like seeing them. You're riding a horse across here, and you know, ever since I was a little kid, they fly off like a pheasant, you know, but there's usually several of them, and you know, it's pretty cool to see him.
He's agreed to permanently keep about 14,000 acres undeveloped as part of what's called a conservation banking agreement. In exchange, Gardner gets paid by investors, such as energy companies, that want to offset their impacts. Gardner says this conservation helps the lesser prairie chicken and helps him meet his own goal, to leave the land better than he found it.
Ecosystems and environments are important. Prairie chickens are important, you know, wildlife's important, but people are too. And so when we can make all those things be healthy, have a healthy ecosystem for all, then we can all go forward together.
Getting more landowners on board will take education and mentorship, according to Trey Lamb. He's the executive director of the Oklahoma Conservation Commission. Lamb says mimicking Mother Nature helps both crops, livestock, and wildlife.
It's a change in culture. It's a change in how you manage your property. You do it differently than your father and grandfather did. Maybe you do it a little more like your great-grandfather did. You just don't realize it.
Lamb says voluntary conservation helped other wildlife populations, like bald eagles. Now, it's about getting the public behind protecting lesser prairie chickens. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Anna Pope.
This story was co-reported with Chloe Bennett Steele of State Impact Oklahoma.
Coming up on this Monday edition of Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Public, we'll pay tribute to a singer-songwriter that Mike Olson has been playing for decades, one that just passed away recently, Todd Snyder. And we'll catch another story from The Tell, Fargo's live monthly storytelling event, about giving birth and the expectations that come with it. A very compelling story is on the way. Don't miss it.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A North Dakota coalition hopes to soon gather signatures for a citizen-led ballot initiative where free school meals for all K-12 students would be up for consideration. Organizers say universal lunches are the right way to improve the state's educational fortunes. As Mike Moan reports, the Together for School Meals coalition submitted the proposed state constitutional ballot measure to the Secretary of State's office.
If adopted, every student, regardless of their family's income, would have access to one no-cost breakfast and lunch every school day. Coalition member Rhonda Nelson says there's a body of research that illustrates the benefits of this approach.
We know that when kids have a healthy breakfast and lunch, they perform better academically, behavior issues decline, and our attendance rates increase.
One example is a 2021 study from the Brookings Institution, which links school-wide free meals to improved math performance. 9 other states, including Minnesota, have adopted these programs, with supporters noting there are many food insecure students who don't qualify for free or reduced price lunches. While it has expanded eligibility, the North Dakota legislature so far has voted down proposed bills on the universal model, with opponents citing cost concerns. Organizers say the coalition consists of parents, teachers, farmers, and advocates, along with organizations such as the Union North Dakota United. Statewide polling has consistently shown that voters like the idea of a free school meal program that covers all students. Nelson says any extra cost would be worth it in the long run when trying to envision a stronger workforce.
We can invest now, or we can pay for it later.
Nelson also leads the Boys and Girls Club of the Red River Valley and says the coalition worked to ensure ballot language was carefully crafted so that residents are clear on what's being proposed. That is seen as a crucial way to avoid any potential legal setbacks if the ballot initiative is challenged. If the Secretary of State signs off on the paperwork, more than 31,000 signatures would be needed to place the measure on the 2026 ballot. This is Mike Moen for Prairie News Service.
And 6 enhanced oil recovery projects were approved by the State Industrial Commission. Those projects received a total of $42.5 million. That money comes from the state's Oil and Gas Research Council.
They're longer lead projects. They're large-scale EOR pilot projects generally utilizing raw field gas.
State Director of Mineral Resources Nathan Anderson says if these projects are successful, it could have a big impact on North Dakota production going forward.
The EERC has information out there showing there's been 5 billion barrels produced in the state so far, and I would think that that could easily double in the case that EOR works well in the Bakken, the Middle Bakken Shale.
Anderson says contracts and plans are being worked out to get those projects going. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
It's Main Street for this first Monday in December on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Eric Dethridge. Craig Blumenschein will be back with you tomorrow. We know we have a very hardworking colleague here at Prairie Public who is just about to give birth to her first child. The excitement is palpable. And for those of us who have gone through it, I mean women, I don't mean me included in that us, though I was there to bear witness to my daughter entering the world. There isn't some kind of operatic music playing or clouds parting the moment it happens. And definitely not speaking for myself here, but as an observer, that the feeling for some mothers, understandably, is get this alien thing out of me now. Still, we sometimes fall victim to societal expectations, don't we? And that's the story we're about to hear, recorded earlier this month at the 4&4 in Fargo for the live monthly storytelling event, The Tell. Here's Kelly Billings.
Closing time. Every new beginning comes from some other beginnings.
So just to preface this, I have a 16-month-old, very healthy, happy little boy that we are very blessed to have. He was born on June 24th. 2024, and it was quite a journey, not in the fact that I had all these difficulties to overcome, like quite the opposite. It was a pretty smooth pregnancy and everything. It's just expectation got in my way. And my frenemy is a little bit more abstract. It's not a person in this case, but it is the expectation itself. I'll explain a little bit. So we tried for a few months to get pregnant. We had no luck, so we kind of gave up for a little bit, decided to get a dog instead. We got a puppy, and it must have clicked on some sort of maternal instinct, because within 1 month, I kid you not, I was pregnant at 39 years old. So that's really fun, because then they consider it a geriatric pregnancy, which probably a lot of you know. And so not only expectation as a frenemy, but also kind of community culture around all these things, and the fact that it was a geriatric pregnancy. So high risk. You get to have more tests, more ultrasounds, things like that, covered by insurance, woohoo. Downside, they tell you every single thing that could go wrong, fill your brain with worry and stress unnecessarily. And so thank goodness we had a really great doctor who kept his head up, kept me minimally stressed throughout the process. So fast forward 7 months along, we're doing good. We go in for a checkup. He's at 55th percentile. Great, everything's going well, I feel great. Going a month later, he's now at the 30th percentile. Okay, a little different, something might be up, but not too much to worry. We go on the beginning of June, he's now at the 5th percentile. My heart drops. And then you start to worry. But again, my doctor kept us positive, reminded us everything else was still looking good, not sure what's going on, but hey, let's be safe, let's take him out via C-section at 38 weeks. Okay, sounds like a good plan. At least it's a planned. We know what we're doing. It's not an emergency C-section. Again, things are still going pretty smoothly. Very grateful. We get to my appointment before the C-section. So back to the expectation. We have about a 1 minute explanation of what's going to happen. The incision's going to be here, this and that. Okay, sounds good. Still not too worried. My mom had my sister and I both C-section. I know other friends. And expectation that came with that and what I heard from the community was, hey, no big deal, you'll be fine, you might feel a little tugging, this or that. And okay, sounds good to me, it's really common procedure, no worries. So I felt good until the night before, then I just about had a panic attack. Everything hit me, giant needle going in my back, being cut wide open while being wide awake. This doesn't seem like a normal thing we should be doing. And so, calm myself down, get through the night, come morning, show up. I have my headphones in, listening to meditations, music, anything I could while they get me ready, and just to stay calm. And then we go into the prep room where you sign your life away on that liability form. And then they walk you into the operating room, which I wish had been a part of the tour, but it was not. I don't know if any of you have been in one. But my first thought, growing up, somebody watching X-Files and other sci-fi movies, was alien probe. You just see a big bright light and just a metal table, a big open room, just feels really cold. I mean, really sterile, thankfully, but it doesn't set the right mood for, hey, you're gonna meet your baby in about a half hour. And so I get on the table, we start this process, they give you the shot, which is terrifying in itself, and you lay down, they tell you you're supposed to be numb from about the waist down. So that starts to happen really quickly, and it keeps going up, up, up. Now I freak out that I'm going to lose control of my lungs and not be able to breathe, because mine went up a lot higher. Thankfully, I had a great anesthesiologist. She talked me through everything. She was like rubbing my forehead, calming me down. And this whole process, I'm like, my baby's coming through all this? This is crazy. And then they get to the point where they go to lower the sheet, so you can see your baby getting taken out. And they go to lower the sheet, it starts coming down, and then there's a pause, and then it starts going back up. And I'm like, uh-oh. Meanwhile, I'm hopped up on meds, already stressed to the max, you know, trying to deal with all the cortisol in my body, trying not to pass out. And then a minute later, it goes back down again. Nobody told me what was going on. I found out later. So apparently part of my uterus was more constricted, and they had to cut extra and whatever to get them out. And through this process, They were vigorously tugging. So this gentle tugging that people described to me was more of the whole table violently up and down shaking. And it pulled so hard, it pulled a muscle in my shoulder. And so my baby comes out, and expectation, you think of this, you know, you're set up for this beautiful process, they lay him on your chest, you're just, your heart's bursting open with love, and that's not what happened. They took him over to a table, he was fine, again, thankfully, all this pretty normal, pretty smooth, grateful. My fiance's over with him, but I don't see any of it, I don't see the cord cutting, I don't see any of what's happening, but they reassure me he's okay. And then came the part I expected least. They asked me if I was ready to see my son, and my answer was no. Hard for me to talk about. I haven't really shared this story with many people. And the guilt and shame that overwhelmingly hit me in that moment, because I was barely containing myself. How am I going to handle and see this newborn thing? And they gave me a minute or two. I composed myself, and I was ready, and they brought him over, and I put my hand on his head, and I just start weeping. But still not that feeling that people tell you you're going to get of just your heart bursts open, you just have all this love and butterflies and elation. And just that guilt again of like, what's wrong with me? Why isn't this what I'm feeling? And then, so we fast forward, we go through a couple hours, you get like the shakes for a couple hours as you come off all the medication, which nobody tells you about either. And spend 3 days in the hospital. And some days I look at my son, and I think he's the most perfect, beautiful thing in the world, and some days I'm like, who's this alien somebody put in my arms? And it's just, you know, really through this whole experience, and even being pregnant too, I want to back up, and I know I'm out of time, but give me one more minute, I promise I'll wrap up. When I found out I was pregnant, I'm 39 years old, I've been waiting a long time to have kids, I was really looking forward to it, and I saw that pregnancy test come through, and I wasn't hit with excitement. I was just numb. I was in shock, and it took me months to digest that I was finally actually pregnant. And just, again, something a lot of people don't talk about. And just the expectation of you're supposed to be this, like, happy pregnant person and just loving all the connection in the moments, and I never had that through my whole pregnancy. Like, towards the end, I finally started to feel a little bit more connected. But it was just weird. It's just weird because it's not what you hear you're supposed to be. And so it took me a few months. I bonded with my son, you know, on and off over the hours and the days. And I have moments where my heart bursts and I'm just so grateful and I am overwhelmed with joy. But it wasn't right away and it wasn't all the time. And I just really had to find my way to make peace with that within myself and accept that life is all of it. It's the tears and the joy. It's the ups and the downs. It's the shame and the grief and the regret, but also all of the good times too, and just really that life lesson was brought to me really strongly through that whole experience. So thanks for letting me share.
I know you have a lot of strength left. I know you have a little life in you yet. I know you have.
Kelly Billings telling the story of her child entering the world and what it felt like and trying to maybe letting go eventually of what is expected of us around that event. The Tell is a live monthly storytelling event at the 4 and 4 in downtown Fargo. The next show is Thursday, December 11th. Showtime is 7 p.m. You can find more info on the Tell Fargo Facebook page or on Instagram. The Alzheimer's Association Minnesota, North Dakota, with funding granted through the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services Aging Services Section, is offering the Dementia Care Services Program. With classes offered at many locations in Minnesota and North Dakota, this month learn healthy living, building foundations of caregiving, and how to utilize the 24/7 helpline available in more than 200 languages. Learn more about the Dementia Care Services Program at alz.org/MNND. Hope you are enjoying the show on this Monday. I'm Eric Detheridge, and for Craig, you are listening to Main Street. Well, it's been a couple of tough weeks for music fans. Last week, we learned about the passing of one of the artists you'd have to put on the Mount Rushmore of reggae music, Jimmy Cliff. I was a huge fan. I still play his live album on many occasions. Now, if you only know him for his version of I Can See Clearly Now, just take a listen to one of the most poignant songs I've ever heard written about war and conflict, Vietnam. Just a human, human song. but we also lost another gem of an artist, alt folk country and sometimes satirical singer-songwriter Todd Snyder, who has been part of Mike Olson's playlist here on Prairie Public for years. We'll pay tribute to Todd for our recurring segment, What Mike Olson's Playing, in just a minute. Stay with us.
I am Cole Maring, and I am from Fargo, North Dakota. I choose to be a Prairie Public Sustainer because of the myriad programs that they have that I find really valuable. Give me a more nuanced view of the world, introduce me to new great music. Oh, I think others should support Prairie Public for the same reason I do. These things don't just happen without us supporting them. Stuff that you're never going to hear, but you're going to love when you do hear it. Yeah, favorite programs and shows. I like to hear my Dakota Datebook every day. I really like Into the Music with Mike Olson. I like the previously the Thomas Jefferson Hour with Clay Jenkinson. Just really, really great stuff. My favorite Prairie Public radio personality, I would have to say, is Dave Thompson. I think that we just need to really do our best to appreciate it more and more.
You could be like Cole and become a sustaining member of Prairie Public today. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the donate tab.
My connection to Todd Snyder dates back to 1994. I was hosting a show on KFJM in Grand Forks, what was then known as Northern Lights Public Radio. Later it folded into the Prairie Public family. Into the Music legend Mike Olson was my boss, and one CD he was pretty keen on was Songs for the Daily Planet. I took a listen, and Todd had me on the first track, My Generation Part 2, a sort of response to The Who.
Here's to living off that as long as you can and blending in with the crowd.
I thought Gen X, which I belong to, deserved a little satirizing at the time. Speaking of that, I wasn't really wise to the guy until Mike led me to a bonus track on the album, one that wasn't even listed, but that you had to fast forward through a lot of dead space on the Sony CD player to find. The payoff, though, was hilarious, a send-up of the Seattle grunge scene that seemed to be churning out brooding, flannel-wearing bands like Chicken Nuggets.
Well, they made us do a video, but that wasn't tough because we just filmed ourselves smashing stuff. It's kind of weird because there was no music, but MTV said they'd love to use it. The kids went wild, the kids went nuts. Rolling Stone gave us a 5-star review, said we played with guts. We were scoring chicks, taking drugs, and we got asked to play MTV Unplugged. You should have seen it. We went right out there and refused to do acoustical versions of the electrical songs that we had refused to record in the first place.
And because we didn't have a delay button at the time,
then we smashed our
every time I played talking Seattle grunge rock blues, I had to be ready to pot down an offending word. Mike Olson kindly marked the time on the CD case until I committed it to memory.
B-double-E-double-R-U-N, beer run.
The funny, witty, self-effacing hardscrabble stoner singer-songwriter was from Portland, Oregon originally. He then moved as a late teen to Austin and eventually Memphis, where he was discovered by Jimmy Buffett, who put him on his Margaritaville label.
A couple of frat guys from Abilene drove out all night to see Robert Earl Keen at the K-Pig. Swine and soiree dance, wore baseball caps, khaki pants. They wanted cigs, so to save some money, they got one off a hippie that smelled kind of funny. The next thing they knew, they was both really hungry and pretty thirsty too.
Later on, Todd's hero John Prine inked him to a deal on his Oh Boy Records. Now, aside from John Prine, one of Todd Snyder's other big influences was Kris Kristofferson, who once told the New York Times that Snyder was as poetic of a writer as anybody and that Todd's words could move you emotionally in the direction that he wanted, but without you being actually conscious of it. Very high praise from one of the greatest.
Friend of a friend from work came in. I never had known what to make of him. He'd always seemed to be so insincere to me. You know, I've always been afraid of a 12-step crowd. They laugh too much, talk too loud, like they all know where everyone should be.
After moving to the emerging off-Opry artist community in the Music City, Todd became affectionately known as the Mayor of East Nashville. He became known for mentoring and nurturing and helping out other artists. In fact, many are singing his praises on social media. I owe my career to Todd Snyder. I was down and out. He let me open a show. He gave me songwriting tips. The love for Todd Snyder is just pouring out. The crowning achievement of his time in Tennessee had to be East Nashville Skyline, which came out in 2004. That record produced one of many self-effacing anthems.
Tree-hugging, love-making, pro-choice and gay wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed.
Todd battled demons on stage. His concerts recently have been reportedly erratic and off, including an addiction to OxyContin. And by now, you may have read accounts about a supposed assault on him in Salt Lake City recently. Now there are some questions as to the truthfulness of his account and his entering a hospital there for treatment and then being kicked out for allegedly being belligerent to the staff there. But not too long after, he succumbed to pneumonia, according to his family, and was dead at the age of 59.
Yellow rose, wake old moon, quit too late, die too soon. Woman with a needle and a silver spoon, hold up singing the devil's tune.
Now, like a lot of troubadours and rock stars, Todd Snyder lived a hard life offstage, almost so he could deliver the goods night after night of hilarious and tender songs. It was hard for him to separate the professional from the personal. That's what he was all about. Todd Snyder, you can hear his collection on Into the Music with Mike Olson. Listen on the radio between 9 and 10 a.m. and noon to 6 weekdays and on our Roots Rock and Jazz stream at prairiepublic.org or ask a smart speaker to play us. To quote another one of Todd's self-effacing anthems, he certainly was an all right guy.
I know I get wild.
Hi, I'm Danielle Webster, host of All Things Considered weekday afternoons on Prairie Public. I hope you'll join me for a mix of global and national news from NPR and important stories from right here in the Prairie region. I'll keep an eye on the weather for you, as well as fun community events you should know about. It's a great way to make the drive home more bearable. But don't be mad if we make you late for supper because of a compelling driveway moment. All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
Danielle and All Things Considered is coming up next here on member-supported Prairie Public. If you're listening during the 3 p.m. Central broadcast to Main Street, the big story today, recovery efforts in Jamaica around Hurricane Melissa and the $8 billion in damage it left in its wake. So the big question is, do they rebuild with wood or concrete? Rebuilding Jamaica from Resilience on All Things Considered up next. If you're listening during the evening version of Main Street, stay tuned for Hidden Brain with Shankar Vedantam. American kids are spending far less time playing with each other than previous generations. Why kids need to play is coming up on Hidden Brain. Stay with us.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 1st. Once there was a man who came to Dakota seeking his fortune. He prospered and proposed marriage to a lady back east. But she hesitated to come to Wahpeton, terrified of tornadoes. To ease her fears, the man constructed a home known locally as the Tornado Proof House. It featured a sturdy lookout tower where his bride could watch the skies for coming storms. This story was told by pioneer daughter Donna Faulkner. R.N. Inc. built the house with solid 2x6 plank walls and partitions like grain elevator construction. Inc. held various public offices over the years, including City Council, Richland County Sheriff, and State Senator. Like many who came to Wahpeton in the boom years, he was involved in several enterprises, real estate, farm loans, and law. Newspapers frequently reported on the society doings of Mr. and Mrs. Inc., along with other well-to-do locals. But in 1897, the Inc. divorce shocked the community and became a public scandal. Papers followed every detail from the first rumors of pending action. The courtroom was packed with eager spectators, but during the proceedings, everyone was sent out due to the sensitive nature of Mrs. Ink's testimony. She had sued for divorce on grounds of extreme cruelty, drunkenness, and adultery. The Globe reported custody arrangements for the couple's child, upholding Mrs. Ink's request that the child's one-week visit with her father take place at the home of some respectable family other than the home of John Ink, brother. R.N. Ink remarried in June of 1900. Alta remarried that November, but not without a fresh scandal and a scolding from the press. On this date in 1900, talk of the town centered on a story printed the previous day. The marriage of Alta Ink to lawyer Bruce Bogart, widower, is quite a surprise to a large portion of this community. Ink and Bogart were cousins, almost like brothers. But Mrs. Ink's divorce suit involved division of a large amount of property. Mr. Bogart appeared as the friend, sympathizer, and advisor of Mrs. Ink. Animosity between he and Mr. Ink became as strong as their friendship had been. This case enforces an old admonition to married people to avoid an excess of intimacy between families. By 2025, the Tornado Proof House had outlived the Ink marriage by 128 years. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Lee Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Every Saturday, starting November 15th through December 20th, we go beyond our weekday Dakota Datebook episodes with six special weekend editions. Using sound effects and richer storytelling, bringing North Dakota history to life like never before.
You can help win the battle of food production.
Listen Saturdays and Sundays at 7:35 a.m. Central on Prairie Public, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
If you haven't heard those weekend Dakota Datebooks yet, you can check them out on the weekends at 7:35 a.m. Central, both Saturday and Sunday mornings. You could also find it at prairiepublic.org. Just click on the Listen tab. Our radio studio operator and producer, Tay Calloway, is very clever in how he repurposes these stories with lots of sound and sound effects. They're just a joy to behold. I hope you get a chance to put your ears to that. My name's Eric Dethridge. I've been hanging out with you today and all last week on Main Street while Craig Blumenschein is away. He'll be back in the host chair tomorrow. It's been nothing short of a pleasure to be with you. Take care. Have a great rest of your Monday.